You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last December, the South Texas Family Residential Center, which can house 2,400 people, officially opened in Dilley, Texas. If you're wondering what a family residential center is, it's the government's name for a detention camp that holds families who've entered the U.S. illegally. New York Times journalist Will Hilton's report on the situation of tens of thousands of undocumented immigrants was in the February 4th edition of the New York Times magazine. The Shame of America's Family Detention Camps is available on the Times website, and we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. And I'm very pleased that it brings Will Hilton to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Have you seen the detention center in Dilley or any of the other centers?
I have, yes. I did a little tour of the region, including the one in Artesia, New Mexico, which has since been closed. Unfortunately, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office of the Department of Homeland Security refused to allow me access to these facilities, or at least any kind of meaningful access to the facilities, which I found was consistent with the way they denied access to other sort of investigators, watchdogs, and even the attorneys representing these women and children.
So lawyers and aid workers don't have access to these camps?
There have been tours. They're very limited tours. Oftentimes the tours are given to some parts of the camps but not to others. And in the case of the attorneys, for example, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, AILA, had its lead attorney on the ground in Artesia, New Mexico, from about August of last year until the camp closed in December. During that time, she requested three times to be taken on any sort of tour of the facility and was denied all three times. So it's a very limited access.
What about international agencies like the Red Cross or human rights groups? Isn't the U.S. obligated under its international commitments to grant access to them?
Yes, it certainly is. And there are real questions about the legality of these camps. In fact, some of the policies that are in place at these camps have recently, on February 20th, been shut down. There's been an injunction by a federal judge in Washington to stop the no-release policy that these women are subjected to because it's clearly not consistent with American asylum law.
Do the family centers only hold women and children?
What
happens to the men?
Well, so the men are separated in this kind of often very traumatic experience at the border. When a family that includes, you know, a father or husband or boyfriend figure presents themselves to immigration authorities and says, you know, we fear persecution in our home country, and we'd like to file a refugee claim in the United States. They are nevertheless separated, and the men are sent to men's detention facilities, and the women and children are sent to these what they call family detention facilities. And this is a new policy that was just begun last summer.
And what is the rationale for separating families?
Well, so there are rules that that determine the conditions in which women and children, particularly children, must be kept. I mean, we all sort of remember the attention that was given to the unaccompanied minors last summer. But when minors are accompanied, there's a little more argument about what conditions they must be kept in. But it's fairly clear that they must be separated. They're required by, you know, case law, by prior precedent, to be separated from adult strangers. And so the concern is that if men, women, and children are all being kept in the same facilities, that the residents and their attorneys' concerns will be triggered by the fact that children are being kept with adult male strangers.
Are these detention centers designed to facilitate the deportation of undocumented immigrants as quickly as possible?
That's exactly what they're for. I mean, the Obama administration has been very clear about that, maybe to their credit, maybe not. But they have not sort of...
Well, the critics deny that they are trying to do this, but it seems to me that this is even more extreme than what the Bush administration was doing.
I think it is. I mean, so the Bush administration tried to create camps like this. They created one called the Tidon Hutto Detention Facility that was just above Austin, Texas. And it was shut down. Within a couple of years, there was a lawsuit, and it had to be shut down. The Obama administration came into office right about that time and then implemented the shutdown. And so beginning in 2009 and continuing until 2014, the Obama administration's policy was basically an acknowledgement that this was not a legal way to go about conducting business. And so there was one facility of about 100 beds in Berks County, Pennsylvania, for the most extreme cases where there was a specific reason to detain a family seeking asylum. But we now have, you know, we've gone from May of 2014 with those 100 beds or so to today they're opening approximately 3,700 beds for the spring, what they expect to be a spring rush of immigration.
Now, how does this work in conjunction with the goal the president announced about his immigration executive order?
You know, I think it's really important to understand that. I think that's really one of the key questions. You know, as of last summer, there's now a really binary split in President Obama's approach towards undocumented immigration. You have these sort of twin pillars. On the one hand, he's granted a great number of new rights and freedoms to millions of established families who've been in the United States, generally speaking, for more than 5 years. So he worked very hard to try to pass the DREAM Act legislation. That didn't work out. That would have applied to immigrants who arrived before the age of 16. But when that proved to be unfruitful, he issued an executive action called DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, in 2012 to block the deportation of a lot of the same kids and who would have been covered by the DREAM Act. Then last November, on November 20th, he added another executive action that would protect undocumented parents. And so these policies have really moved things forward in terms of families who have been here for a long time and are seeking some kind of relief from the perpetual threat of deportation. But none of these policies really do anything to address the crisis that's unfolding on the border today, where we see a flood of families coming mostly from Central America, where conditions are absolutely horrific, and seeking not economic opportunity in the United States, but really survival, a chance to get away from the imploding chaos, the political catastrophe that's unfolding in Central America right now.
My guest is Will Hilton, whose article, The Shame of America's Family Detention Camps, was published in the New York Times magazine last month. How many people are crossing the border into the United States on an average month?
So, of course, it depends a little bit on how you count, and the average is a little tricky because there are high periods and low periods of traffic. But the most recent numbers that I came up with are about 61,000 what they call family units crossing the border in the last year, and about 51,000 unaccompanied children. So altogether, you know, more than 100,000 people coming mostly from these Central American countries.
That's because the U.S. economic downturn resulted in a decline in immigration from Mexico?
Right, and also advances in the Mexican economy as well. So the opportunity, you know, the need for economic relief and search for jobs has really changed a lot since 2008 for people coming from Mexico. But it's changed just as much in the opposite direction for people in Central America who have watched their homeland really devolve into a humanitarian disaster. The four of the five highest murder rates in the world are in Central America right now. And so a lot of these migrants are coming from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, and the stories they tell, in case of every family in one of these facilities, they have already passed the initial screening to indicate that they have what's called a credible fear of returning to their country, where they very likely will be persecuted if not killed. And so the people who are being detained in these facilities for months or more than a year at a time are people who have already sort of met our legal standards to begin the asylum process.
How often does the United States grant asylum requests to these detained immigrants?
Well, the policy
does it send some of them back, even though it's admitted that they face danger back home?
The, the administration certainly has done that. And in fact, I spoke with people, elected officials from Texas and from New Mexico, who told me that they've been getting reports from some of these Central American countries, from faith groups that are working down there, that some of these kids have already been killed after having been deported back to Central America from our detention facilities.
What happens if the women and children entering the United States have relations already living here? Couldn't they just stay with them?
Historically, that's been exactly what the policy is. So historically, after somebody meets the credible fear interview and shows that they have a valid basis to proceed through the asylum court process, the families have been allowed to live with relatives, and almost all of them have relatives. So it's not that there's some small number for whom that's an option. It's almost all of them. And historically, we've found that when they're placed in some kind of monitoring program just to keep track of where they've moved and who they're living with, you get anywhere from 93 to 96% of people turn up for their asylum hearings in court. So almost everybody shows up in court. The Obama administration is now arguing that they can't continue that policy because what they claim to be a national security concern, and that if they allow these families to go live with relatives in the United States, it'll have, quote, significant adverse national security consequences. Now, what those consequences might be, they don't specify.
Are they suggesting that these people are jihadis?
Yeah, I think that seems to be what's implied. I mean, if it weren't so sad to think that that's the claim being made against these women and children, it would be laughable, because when you've been to these facilities and you've seen these women and children, I mean, they're clearly people who have already been through a nightmarish, grueling journey just to survive. I mean, they're so exhausted and fatigued and traumatized by the experience of fleeing their home country and coming, 1,800 miles in many cases to get here, that the idea of seeing these people as threats rather than victims is absolutely preposterous.
When you say children, isn't there a disagreement between the federal government and the states as to what is a child?
There can be. I mean, in this case, among the families who are living in these facilities, the average age is 6. So it becomes a little bit of a moot point. I mean, when we get up to teenagers who are 16, 17, we can change our terms and we can have sort of linguistic debates. But for most of the kids who are living in these facilities, there's really no question. And it's also helpful to remember that for kids this age, this kind of incarceration has an even greater toll. I mean, a child who is struggling to adapt to those conditions can have irreparable long-term harm. And in fact, that's what the district court judge found on February 20th. He used the term irreparable harm to describe what's happening to these kids after 18 months in these facilities living as prisoners.
According to a map on the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement website, there are 82 detention facilities, but the ACLU website reports that there are over 250. Is there disagreement or confusion over what's happening to undocumented immigrants when they're held in the United States?
There may be. I mean, a lot of this is definitional as well. So, we have people who are being jailed or detained, depending on what phrasing you're most comfortable with, because they have crossed over the border sort of seeking a better life. And then we have people who have crossed over and specifically surrendered themselves to the authorities as asylum seekers. And so there are all sorts of, and those are just two sort of broad categories. And there are all sorts of different sort of subcategories to decide what you're going to call a detention facility, how people are housed, what category of relief application they fit into. But one thing that is impossible to dispute is that all of these sort of communities of people put together represent a rising number of detainees. I mean, I think it was something like 5,000 detained immigrants in the United States in 1994. And these numbers are available at the Detention Watch Network. We're in the 50,000 range at a minimum now. So this policy of putting immigrants into jails sometimes for very, very long periods of time while we determine what their legal status should be is rising, and it's rising commensurate with profits for the prison companies which run these facilities.
And we'll look into all of that, how they're being housed and who is running these facilities after we take a little break. My guest is Will Hilton of the New York Times. His article, The Shame of America's Family Detention Camps, appeared in the New York Times Magazine last month. We have a link to it on our show page. You can also find it on the Times website. Stay with us for more. We're back with Will Hilton, whose article, The Shame of America's Family Detention Camps, appeared last month in the New York Times Magazine. According to Time Magazine, Will, it will cost $296 per person per day to house people at Dilley. You can get a pretty nice hotel room in Manhattan for that money.
Yes, it's startling. I mean, it comes to something over $100,000 per person per year.
Why is it so expensive?
Well, the facility itself, this is one of the sort of ironies of it. The Dilley facility itself is a radical departure from the abysmal conditions in which detainees have been housed in the past. Now, it's sort of just standing up, so we're going as much on promissory images posted on the facility's website and sort of blueprints and plans that have been drawn by architects as we are by the actual experience of detainees. But the plan is to have this sort of dormitory housing with outdoor pavilions and a chapel and several playgrounds and all of this, sort of higher quality of life available to the imprisoned immigrants. And so that costs a lot more money than the kind of rundown trailer park in which everyone was being housed in Artesian, New Mexico, until last December. So it also kind of changes the debate in a sense, because the question is no longer as much about the physiological harm that's being done to children who are placed into the camps, or it may not be as much about that as it is about the psychological harm of being incarcerated.
But some of these detention facilities are part of jails, like the Yuba County Jail in California, the Bergen County Jail in Hackensack, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So the government is holding children in jails?
Well, so the government has three facilities right now for the children. There's one in Karnes County, Texas. There's one in Dilley, Texas. And there's one in Berks County, Pennsylvania. And these are distinct from adult jails or civilian jails. They're not the populations are not mixed. However, they are being run by the largest prison, for-profit prison company in America, the Corrections Corporation of America, which also, you know, handles other sorts of detention facilities for immigrants, including the one in Eloy that's become quite famous, Eloy, Arizona.
Do the children get schooling or other services that children need?
Well, they're required. This is an interesting point of contention, and it's one that I really dug into. The law says pretty clearly in a settlement that's called the Flores decision that children, any immigrant child that's detained by ICE, by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, must be given when they're kept, because they're supposed to be, all children are supposed to be subject to a general policy favoring release, which they're clearly not being given. But when they are to be kept, they're supposed to be not only granted sort of medical care and privacy from adult strangers, but also adequate exercise and education. And as I looked into the Artesia facility, I heard from a number of residents, their lawyers, and even elected officials from nearby who had been sort of investigating this new facility that plopped into their backyard, that the school was essentially not functioning. And when I asked ICE about that, when I asked administration officials at ICE about that, they gave me this very opaque line that the school had opened in October and continued through December. But as soon as I probed that to find out if it was consistently open during that period or intermittently open during that period, and for how many hours per day or week it was open, they refused to respond. And it took a long time to get answers from the Secretary's office, from Secretary Jay Johnson of Homeland Security's office, finally responded to me and acknowledged that it was open only intermittently during that period. And all of the detainees I spoke with said that it was only open for maybe an hour a day when it was open. So the answer, I think, is that there was not sufficient schooling or not in keeping with the requirements of the law.
There's a 1997 legal case that you mentioned, Flores versus Meese. Didn't the Bush administration largely ignore court rulings that granted some rights to detainees?
Yes. In fact, the Obama administration has also ignored those court rulings. So the initial case that shut down this program under the Bush administration that curtailed the way the program was being run by the Bush administration, the settlement for Flores, in that case, the federal judge called it, quote, inexplicable. The judge who reviewed the government's detention policy towards children under the Bush administration. And it was that decision and that lawsuit and that set of concerns which led to the abolition or the virtual abolition of family detention from 2009 until last year. And since having re-implemented family detention, the Obama administration has returned to the same kinds of facilities, the same kinds of care that judge declared inexplicable. And the Obama administration has had attorneys arguing in court as recently as August that those Flores terms do not apply to children who are being detained with their parents. In other words, kids who are living with their parents don't have to go to school. Which makes no sense to anyone who has kids living with them. That doesn't affect whether they need schooling. But this is explicitly what the attorneys for the Obama administration have argued in court. And, I mean, you can read the transcripts of these things. It's kind of startling to see attorneys for the Department of Homeland Security arguing that kids who live with their parents don't have to go to school. And judges have continued to reject this position. So in an important ruling last September, a judge named Roxanne Ladlewich ruled that these children in these family detention camps are absolutely covered, and that the Flores settlement agreement absolutely applies to all minors in detention, not only those who are unaccompanied by their parents. But the Obama administration has continued, to me anyway, and in all public statements that I'm aware of, to refuse comment on whether or not they will change their policy and consider the Flores agreement and the Flores terms, those requirements, applicable to children in family detention. They will not concede that children who are being detained with their parents are entitled to these kinds of schooling and care requirements.
My guest is Will Hilton. His article, The Shame of America's Family Detention Camps, appeared in the New York Times Magazine last month. We have a link to it on our show page. You can also find it on the New York Times website. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Getting back to Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, which is running many of these centers, do policymakers think that running a detention center for families is much the same as running a prison, which is CCA's main business?
I suppose they must. And I mean, one can think of ways in which it would be similar, but I don't think it's particularly challenging to think of ways in which it's not. And so there are real questions raised about sort of taking one kind of apparatus, that of the conventional prison system, and just dropping it into the detention program for families. So even if these families are to be detained, it may be worth considering what kinds of special conditions they need. And relatedly, it may be worth pushing for a more clear response from the Obama administration on whether or not the new facilities for these families have to meet the terms of the Flores settlement, have to have the right kinds of schools and the right kinds of medical care and so on and so forth. But so far, the Obama administration has refused to sort of acknowledge that there is this difference and that there are these rules that apply to kids in detention.
A year ago, the FBI began a criminal investigation into CCA over the running of what's called the Gladiator School. What's the Gladiator School, and what were the questions there?
So the term Gladiator School was brought forward by inmates who felt that the facility was not safe, that there was a lot of unchecked fighting, and that prisoners would come in relative innocence and come out gladiators, because that's what they believed they were subjected to in order to survive. I mean, in 2010, a video surfaced from this particular facility that showed one inmate beating another inmate into a coma while guards were right outside the window. This is one of several sort of significant controversies that CCA has found itself dealing with.
Another one is the Eloy detention camp, which CCA runs. 13 detainees died there from illness or suicide since 2004.
Is
there any government oversight on these privately run for-profit camps?
Well, federal investigators in Eloy went and checked it out and found that their conclusion was detainee welfare is in jeopardy. That's a direct quote. There is oversight in that sense, but what they're finding is certainly troubling. A couple of years ago, CCA executives admitted that their employees in Idaho had falsified 4,800 hours of business records, of staffing records, to the state government. So there are real issues that surround CCA, and I think it's worth remembering that CCA was the management company responsible for the T. Don Hutto facility in Texas, which previously implemented this policy and which previously was shut down for such poor implementation of this policy, and now CCA is running the facility in Dilley. So these are legitimate concerns for people who are watching this.
They also have good political connections. They are big contributors to Senator Lamar Alexander and Senator Bob Corker. So they have friends in Congress as well.
Yeah.
But what about legal representation for the people we're talking about, the detainees? How much access to legal representation of advocacy groups do these detainees have?
You know, it's a really, really important question, because these are families, these are women and children who are being kept essentially in prison, right? But they're not entitled to the kinds of representation that prisoners and those accused of crimes are typically entitled to. So there's no...
And why is that? After all, they're on U.S. soil. It's not like they're in Guantanamo, and that argument can be used.
Right. So they're not being charged in the criminal courts. They're not being charged as criminals. And so despite the fact that they're being held and treated as criminals, they're not entitled to the Gideon V. Wainwright protections and the defense attorneys. So what's happened instead is this sort of amazing story of volunteer lawyers, many of them relatively young, so in their late 20s, 30s, sometimes early 40s. Hundreds, mostly women, have come from around the country, flown often on their own dime, to volunteer and to rent hotel rooms outside of these camps and to go into these facilities for a week or two or a month or in some cases many months and just volunteer their time to represent these women and children and try to steward them through the asylum process. Now, it's slow, it's difficult, but they've all together, at last time I tallied it up, they had completed 15 what are called merits hearings, so the full asylum court process. Of those, the courts had granted asylum to 14 of the families. So that sort of tells you something about the quality of the cases and the validity of the claims that these families have. But it's a struggle to find continuing representation. And I got to know a lot of these attorneys, I mean, dozens of them, and they're all concerned that they may not be able to continue this kind of pro bono work at such a scale forever. And so
one of them is Christina Brown, an attorney who was 30 when you met her. How much experience did she have in immigration law?
Almost none. Christine is an amazing story because she arrived at the Artesia, New Mexico detention camp in late July. And she, although she was 30, had even less experience than that might suggest because she had worked on political campaigns for the first few years out of college. And so she had just finished law school a year earlier and had decided after law school that she was going to open a private practice in Denver. But by the time she got to the Artesia detention camp as a volunteer, her private practice in Denver had exactly two clients. So she was somebody who arrived on the scene with very little very little background in it. I mean, she had read and studied on these issues, but she had not practiced in front of a court at all. And so over the course of the next 4 or 5 months, she found that she was unable, her conscience prevented her from leaving. She felt that the need was too great there in Artesia to leave. And so she stayed, and she rented a house. And soon the American Immigration Lawyers Association and a couple other groups started to help fund her to stay there. And she became the on-the-ground point person for all of the hundreds of other attorneys who were coming in to volunteer their time and try to provide representation for these women.
But you make it sound like they're overwhelmed.
They were absolutely overwhelmed. And, I mean, there was a sort of a pattern to it where I spoke with dozens of these women, and they all had been experienced in immigration law, much more so than Christina. I mean, for the most part, these are people who graduated from law school at the sort of normal age and had spent 10 years or so working in immigration law, often had been to Central America and had seen some of the issues there, and felt that, for the most part, felt that they were pretty tough, that they had a pretty good sense of what these cases entail. But they were horrified not so much by the stories that the women in detention told as they were by the conditions in which the women and children were being kept. And there was a sort of a pattern where they'd arrive on Sunday night or Monday morning for a week's worth of volunteering. And by Wednesday, most of the women told me, most of the attorneys who volunteered told me that they just almost couldn't take it anymore. And there were a lot of tears shed. There were long hours, a lot of work, and also the emotional toll of just seeing women and children suffering like that.
Well, just one more thing. The people held in these detention centers are foreign nationals. What have their home governments had to say about this whole situation, how they're being treated, and why they feel they can't return home?
You know, one of the things that distinguishes their home countries in cases like El Salvador, Honduras, is that their home governments are not in charge in large swaths of territory. The gangs, like the 18th Street Gang or Mara Salvatrucha, have taken over. And so they absolutely, none of these countries in Central America whose residents are fleeing to the United States can credibly say that they can protect these women and children if they do return home.
Will Hilton's article, The Shame of America's Family Detention Camps, was in the New York Times Magazine last month. You can access it on the New York Times website, or we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Will, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.